Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Security concerns close two embassies in Cairo. A man accused of murdering his wife is acquitted by a South African judge. I'm Dave DeForest reporting from Washington. Canada has closed its embassy in the Egyptian capital because of security concerns. There was no detailed explanation for the closing today, but a note on its website said the consular services may be limited due to unsettled security conditions. Britain's embassy in Cairo remained closed today for a second day. British officials gave no details of a specific threat or when the facility would reopen. The U.S. ambassador to South Africa says the United States did not know about negotiations to release a South African hostage who was killed Saturday during a raid by U.S. Special Forces. The mission in Yemen aimed to free American journalist Luke Summers, but both men were killed by their captors. Ambassador Patrick Gaspard says the U.S. was unaware that South African teacher Pierre Corky was being held at the same site as Summers. Gaspard reiterated that President Barack Obama ordered the raid because the al-Qaeda militants holding Summers indicated they were going to kill him. A South African judge has acquitted a British man accused of ordering the murder of his wife. Here is Judge Jeanette Traverso.
But in my view, the evidence of these witnesses is so replete with fundamental contradictions on the key components of the state case that I can all but ignore it.
The judge said prosecutors had not given enough evidence to convict 34-year-old Shrein Diwani. He was accused of shooting his wife, Annie, on November 2000. This is VOA News. The Democratic Republic of Congo has a new government. President Joseph Kabila has appointed a government that includes several opposition members. The appointments come a year after he promised to form a national unity cabinet. The 47-member government, headed by Prime Minister Augustin Matata Ponyo, will still be dominated by the ruling party. Moncef Marzouki and Beji Caid Essebsi will be facing off against each other in Tunisia's December 21st election. The election marks the final step in the North African nation's transition to full democracy following the 2011 revolution. Neither candidate gained a majority in the previous election, November 23rd. The AFP reports that Algeria is returning thousands of illegal workers to Niger, according to the Algerian Red Crescent. The first group of returnees arrived Saturday at a reception center in Tamanrasset. From there, the group, mostly women and children, will be taken on to Niger. The operation is expected to take several months. Niger Prime Minister Brigi Raffini had asked the Algerian government to return some 3,000 people, many of whom were reduced to begging. They will send home to their country and about 3,000 people who are jobless, unfortunately, living by begging. The Associated Press reports that members of Congo's former rebel group, M23, are saying they should not be sent back home from Uganda until their government fulfills all of the terms of its peace agreement with the group. The M23 spokesman says he is not convinced that Congo's government is ready to receive them. The 2013 peace agreement called for the repatriation of all fighters by the end of this year. The Congolese government has balked at M23 demands for a blanket amnesty for all of its fighters. The French ambassador says a Russian cargo plane detained Saturday by Nigerian authorities was carrying two French helicopters, according to Reuters. He said the copters were being flown from the Central African Republic to Chad. The ambassador also said Nigerian authorities detained the French crew when the plane landed due to congestion at the Jemena Airport. The Red Cross says at least 21 people were killed when a powerful typhoon hit the Philippines. Philippine Red Cross Secretary General Gwendolyn Pang says at least 18 of the victims died on the eastern island of Samar, where Typhoon Hagupit made landfall late Saturday. The death toll came as the capital, Manila, braced for the arrival of what is now just a tropical storm. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
DRC, there are a number of serious cases where due process is a concern, where freedom of expression is a concern. Eritrea, it's the famous case of the G11, the members of parliament who wrote a critical letter to the authorities, to the president, Afwerki, in 2001, and who were taken away in September that year and never seen again.
That's Roger Hozinga of the International Parliamentary Union. Details coming up.
Also in the news, officials in Yemen report 70 Ethiopians drowned in the Red Sea when their boat capsized on Saturday. And Canada has closed its embassy in the Egyptian capital because of security concerns.
We'll have these stories plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Egypt, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, officials in Yemen's Taiz province report 70 Ethiopians drowned in the Red Sea when their boat capsized on Saturday. The boat sank in strong winds and rough waters off the coast near the port of Al-Maka. There was no indication of their point of departure, but in recent years, many Ethiopians have been smuggled from the Somali coast to Yemen in hopes of finding work in Saudi Arabia. Thousands of East Africans pay smugglers to take them across the shark-infested waters of the Red Sea and the Gulf of Arabia in unsafe boats and difficult weather. Hundreds die each year in the effort.
Canada has closed its embassy in the Egyptian capital because of security concerns. There was no detailed explanation for the embassy in Cairo closing today, but a note on its website said consular services may be limited due to unsettled security conditions. Britain's embassy in Cairo remained closed today for a second day. British officials gave no details yesterday of a specific threat or when the facility would reopen. The Reuters news agency cited a source saying a suspected militant recently detained by Egypt told authorities about plans to target foreign embassies. Meanwhile, the U.S. embassy in Cairo was open today.
This weekend, a third Sierra Leonean doctor, Aiya Solomon Kanayema, died of Ebola. He succumbed to the disease a day after two other doctors died from the virus. Overall, 11 Sierra Leonean doctors have been infected, with one surviving. Dr. Kanayema worked at a children's hospital in the nation's capital. Reporter William Eagle asked Freetown-based reporter Kelvin Lewis if the doctor could have become exposed there to the deadly virus.
We don't actually know how he got exposed to the Ebola, but Dr. Kanayema was working as a pediatrician. He's a specialist. He just came back from specializing, and he works in the children's hospital. It is a government facility right enough, but the claims have been that they have been seeing people outside of the facility, and that may probably be how or where he got infected.
Are there any special efforts being made to curtail exposure to the virus, especially among healthcare workers and doctors?
Well, that has been very slow in coming. When the British made their intervention, they set up an 80-bed facility, and it should have an additional 20-bed, which should be dedicated to the care of healthcare givers. But over 2 weeks ago was when, after a lot of protestations, that the people who are supposed to run the healthcare center, which is Save the Children, started admitting Sierra Leoneans there. The understanding was that the facility was for just British caregivers or expatriate caregivers from other European or American nations, and not for Sierra Leoneans. But after a hue and cry, mainly led by the press, they started accepting. And one of the doctors that they accepted into that facility, Dr. Rogers, he has died.
Also, late last week, a high-ranking government official in charge of the anti-Ebola effort made an announcement of a new measure to try to curb the spread of the virus, which is, correct me if I'm wrong, to arrest those who wash the bodies of those who have died from Ebola. Tell us more about that announcement. How does that ruling work, and what has been the reaction to it?
It came out of frustration by the authorities with the rate of transmission. The rate of transmission for Freetown in particular has been going very high. And for the country as a whole, we've been having cases of 50 and over. It's an average of 50 cases a day, and it's considered to be very high. So out of frustration, the chief executive officer of the National Ebola Response Committee, Paulo Conte, came out with new measures. He said that now he's going to be tough, and when the burial team gets to a house after being called to come and take a corpse, if they find out that the corpse has been washed, which is one of the ways in which the transmission rate is spread, in which the Ebola virus is spread, because it is very active on corpses. He says if people are found to have washed the corpses, they would monitor them for the 21 days to find out if they have become sick. If they have not become sick, they would arrest them and put them in jail. If they become sick, they would wait for them. If they survive, they would arrest them and put them in jail. He says because he has to take a strong measure now to ensure that the transmission is caught and people do adhere to the messages being put out by the government.
Lastly, I understand that a new effort has been introduced this week, that the blood of survivors of Ebola is now being tested for use in those infected. Can you tell us more about that effort and who is in charge of that?
Well, this is being led by the medical superintendent of the Sierra Leone Army, the military. He's Colonel Dr. Safode. He told me that they have decided in conjunction with the WHO to use convalescent blood now to treat Ebola survivors. He said there is a lot of literature about it. They've tested it in several areas, and they found that it would work. And they have started clinical trials here to see how they can use it and how it can help in making people well out of Ebola.
That was reporter Kelvin Lewis in Freetown. He was speaking with VOA reporter William Eagle. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Ruhi, 14 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Officials in Yemen report 70 Ethiopians drowned in the Red Sea when their boat capsized on Saturday. Canada has closed its embassy in the Egyptian capital because of security concerns. And this weekend, a third Sierra Leone doctor has died of Ebola. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
A new report by the Inter-Parliamentary Union finds that worldwide, members of parliament in Africa and Asia are at greater risk of intimidation, imprisonment, and other abuse than in other regions. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the report in Geneva.
The report says members of parliament are subject to multiple abuses, including death, torture, threats, arbitrary arrest and detention. The Interparliamentary Union says the Committee on the Human Rights of Parliamentarians is investigating the cases of 311 MPs from 41 countries, a 13% increase over 2013. The data reveal 38% of the MPs who face governmental abuse are from Africa, 25% from Asia, 18% from the Middle East and North Africa, 14% from the Americas, and 5% from Europe. IPU Human Rights Program Manager Roger Huizenga says the three worst cases in Africa are Democratic Republic of Congo, Zambia, and Eritrea. They represent 25.5% of abuse cases on the continent.
DRC, there are a number of serious cases where due process is a concern, where freedom of expression is a concern. Eritrea, it's the famous case of the G11, the members of parliament who wrote a critical letter to the authorities, to the president, Afwerki, in 2001. And who were taken away in September that year and never seen again. And then the case in Zambia, where there are concerns about the use of the Public Order Act and the limitations that that brings along for the right to freedom of assembly.
In Asia, the IPU cites 78 MPs from 12 countries who are under threat. It singles out the Maldives as the worst violator. It says many of the 27 MPs who have been arrested there have been subject to torture, ill treatment, and other acts of violence. The Middle East and North Africa have the third highest number of alleged human rights violations, with 56 MPs under threat. IPU data show Colombia and Venezuela account for 85% of the 42 lawmakers whose rights are being violated in the Americas. The IPU Rights Committee has examined the cases of 16 European MPs in seven countries, including Belarus and Russia. The IPU says the most frequent violations in Europe in 2014 relate to freedom of assembly and association, lack of fair trial guarantees, and arbitrary detention. Huizenga says most of the cases being investigated by the committee concern opposition party MPs, and the majority are men.
We know as well that there are other cases. For instance, in Somalia alone, several members of parliament have been assassinated this year. It's one of the most dire situations, but it's also a very complicated one. These situations have not been submitted to the committee.
The IPU committee can intervene only at the request of the MP concerned, family members, legal representatives, fellow MPs, or human rights organizations. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
When Timbuktu was liberated in 2013, many Arab and Tuareg residents fled out of fear of retribution after being accused of supporting the Islamist occupation. Now many are returning to find they are still under suspicion. Katerina Hoya reports from Timbuktu on the experience of this community, which has been vital to business and trade in northern Mali.
On the northwestern edge of Timbuktu, where the city gives way to the endless Sahara, a young man, a Tuareg, sits in front of a mud house. He's playing an ngoni, a string instrument common in West Africa. As the Islamist militias gained ground in 2012, he fled to the desert like many Arabs and Tuaregs. Later he got a ride to Mauritania's capital, Nouakchott, on the Atlantic coast, where he went looking for work. He only returned last year, after French troops pushed the Islamists out of major towns in northern Mali in January 2013. Many have since returned to Timbuktu, only to find their shops and homes were vandalized and looted, and to find they're not so welcomed. Traditionally, nomadic Arabs and Tuaregs make up about 13% of Mali's 15.9 million people, the majority of whom are black. Following the liberation, light-skinned Tuaregs and Arabs were viewed as sympathetic to the Islamist occupation. Some had in fact been given senior positions within the armed groups, but many were just traders who depended on goodwill from the militants in order to transport their goods along roads and sell them at markets controlled by the Islamists. Some who stayed here paid with their lives. Human rights groups says dozens of people were killed by the military during and after the military intervention in early 2013. Others disappeared. The most well-known case is that of a 70-year-old man known as Vieux Ali, or Old Ali. He was last seen on the morning of February 14th, when several witnesses says he was arrested by soldiers, shoved into the back of a truck, and put under a blanket. When Mohamed Oud Ali learned about the disappearance of his relative through family members, he returned immediately to Timbuktu to find out what happened to his uncle. Every time I asked, I was told the investigation was underway. No one could tell me what happened to my uncle or the other people who disappeared, Mohamed Oud Ali says. Eventually, the old man's body was found in the desert outside of Timbuktu. Other family members and friends remain missing, says Mohamed Oud Ali. There are cases where family members have identified their relatives. In other cases, they haven't even found the body, Ali says. Almost 2 years after the French-led intervention to free the northern two-thirds of Mali, the people of Timbuktu still reel from the violence forced on them by the armed rebels who occupy the city. There is fear of the jihadists, who may not be in control now, but are here. And the fear of arbitrary arrests by the Malian military remains. In town, peacekeepers patrol the streets. Arab and Tuareg residents say the presence of international soldiers does make them feel safer than in the desert. Inside a flat-roofed house made of sun-dried mud, a group of men gathers. They include Omar Oud Salim, who spent many months in the desert during the occupation and the intervention and is now returning. Timbuktu wasn't safe, so I decided to leave, only to find that the desert wasn't secure either. Bandits, profiting from the rebellion, hijacked cars and stole cattle. Some of them worked with the rebels, Oud Salim says. With the presence of international forces, he hopes the population of Timbuktu can live in peace. I left Timbuktu and stayed abroad for a long time. It wasn't until I heard Kam had returned that I finally dared to go back. I hope that people of all ethnicities can live together, Salim says. Others, however, are less optimistic. In January, the UNHCR estimated 180,000 Malian refugees remained in neighboring countries, mainly Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mauritania. More than 100,000 remain eternally displaced, many of them Tuaregs and Arabs. A stone's throw away from the Timbuktu's famed Sankore Mosque is the recently restored mayor's office. During the occupation, the rebels and later the Islamists looted and destroyed regional government buildings. Sitting behind his desk, the deputy mayor, Khalifa Ag Imama, says continued insecurity and a slow return to the rule of law prevent many of the refugees and displaced from returning. The jihadists have left Timbuktu. However, we still have a long way to go before the city will return to normal, the way it was before the rebellion, Khalifa Ag Imama says. Sporadic violence continues with armed groups targeting UN troops and the general population. The government remains weak, and courts and security forces are not yet up and running. Until they are, many residents will not return home. Katrina Höje for VOA News in Timbuktu.
Police in central Nigeria report that gunmen stormed a medium security prison in the city of Mena in central Niger State and released more than 200 prisoners. It's the third major jailbreak in 2 months, resulting in the escape of an estimated 650 Nigerian prisoners. No armed group has taken credit for the most recent jailbreak, but the Islamist sect Boko Haram and Al-Qaeda-linked group Ansaru are believed behind several prison raids in recent years. One security official said it was doubtful that there were many high-profile suspects from Boko Haram in the Mena prison, which is near the national capital, Abuja. City schools, mosques, and three northern states have been under attack by armed extremists of the Boko Haram sect for 5 years. In the past year, more than 10,000 people have died in a conflict the Nigerian army has been unable to control.
A recent oil spill in Nigeria sent about 3,800 barrels gushing out of a pipeline and into the swamps of the oil-producing Niger Delta. Royal Dutch Shell, whose Nigerian subsidiary manages the ruptured pipeline, says the spill was caused by oil theft, which is a chronic problem for oil producers in Nigeria. Christine reports from Accra, Ghana, with Hilary Uguru in the Niger Delta.
Shell says the Trans-Niger pipeline transports around 180,000 barrels of crude oil per day to the Bonny export terminal. And this is where the latest spill fouled the area around Okolo Launch on Bonny Island in the Niger Delta, polluting the catch of local fishermen who rely on the waterways to make a living. Jürgen Jensen, assistant manager of the Trans-Niger pipeline, says the leak was caused by thieves cracking open a 24-inch pipe in an attempt to siphon off the oil. This isn't the first time this has happened, he says.
We've got thousands of wells in the Delta. Yeah. We cannot be at all these wells. The footprint is just too big. They come to our wellheads, and here you see the consequences. But normally what happens, we do our helicopter overflights in the morning. The barge will have gone. All that we see is a lot of oil around because they do not really care about the environment. Yeah, they just want to get the oil as quickly as possible and get out of there again.
Local communities blame Shell for some of the spills that have fouled the Delta. The people of Bodo, a community that suffered two spills in 2008, are suing the company in a London court. In November, Amnesty International released court documents that it said showed Shell knew its pipeline at Bodo was shoddy. Shell denies the claim. The extent of oil theft in the Delta is visible from the air. A VOA reporter who was taken on a helicopter flight over the Delta by Shell counted as many as 1,000 illegal refineries processing the stolen crude and a sunken tanker that had capsized as it was loading illicit fuel. Shell loses 30,000 barrels daily to theft, Jensen says, but trying to stop the theft slows down production even more.
We need to shut in our lines every time. We do it in batches. So that means your line is shut in, you cannot produce the oil. It's still in the ground, it's not stolen, it's still there, you can produce it later on, but no longer this year. We are approximately at 100,000 barrels a day that we cannot produce, that we have got as deferred oil as a result of oil theft. Outside of Nigeria, I've not come across anything that is as widely spread and as active as here in Nigeria.
Shell managed to retrieve 1,340 barrels of oil that was spilled, while another 780 evaporated, Jensen says. The rest was visibly floating on the water's surface. Chris Stein, along with Hilary Uhuru, for VOA News.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
This is a public service announcement from VOA Africa. U.S. President Barack Obama addressing the Ebola crisis.
Hello. I want to take a few moments to speak directly to you, the people of West Africa. On behalf of the American people, I want you to know that our prayers are with those of you who have lost loved ones during this terrible outbreak of Ebola. Along with our partners around the world, the United States is working with your governments to help stop this disease. Stopping this disease won't be easy, but we know how to do it. Together, we can treat those who are sick with respect and dignity. We can save lives, and our countries can work together to improve public health so this kind of outbreak doesn't happen again. In this urgent work and in building a stronger and more prosperous Africa, you'll continue to have a partner in me and in the United States of America.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Officials in Yemen report 70 Ethiopians drowned in the Red Sea when their boat capsized on Saturday. Canada has closed its embassy in the Egyptian capital because of security concerns. And police in central Nigeria report that gunmen stormed a medium security prison and released more than 200 prisoners. Coming up, we'll have music from Egypt. And in our feature segment, we focus on the political situation in Nigeria. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have some kudos for a Major League Soccer club.
Kim, here's a Sunny Side of Sports salute to the Major League Soccer champion Los Angeles Galaxy, who lifted their record fifth MLS Cup with a 2-1 victory in extra time over the visiting New England Revolution. Irish international Robbie Keane, the league most valuable player, scored on a breakaway in the 111th minute to delight the partisan crowd in Southern California. And speaking of Southern California, it marked a victorious championship exit for Southern California native Landon Donovan, the Galaxy star who was playing in his final match. The retiring 32-year-old Donovan, the all-time leading scorer in Major League Soccer, as well as for the USA national team, was in a jubilant mood after his successful swan song. He grabbed a megaphone and had this to say to the cheering fans.
On behalf of all of us, I love L.A. We love you guys. And we're the first to five, baby. Yeah, baby.
As Landon Donovan just said, the Los Angeles Galaxy is the first MLS club to win five league titles. The game went into extra time after Chris Tierney equalized for the Revolution in the 79th minute. The Galaxy took a 1-0 lead in the 52nd minute on a goal by Jossi Zardes. Talk to us, Jossi.
It was just an amazing game. It was a hard battle. Cramping up. Everybody was cramping up on the field, but look at this. A victory. Well deserved.
Meanwhile, it marked another heartbreaking loss for the New England Revolution in the MLS Cup final. New England has now lost five times in the MLS Cup without a victory, including three times to the Galaxy on extra time goals. Galaxy defender Omar Gonzalez says the Revolution showed a lot of fighting spirit.
New England came in. They worked hard. They gave us a tough battle. But champions find a way to win. And you know what? Today we did that, and that's why we won another one. First to five. Here we go.
Congratulations once again to Omar Gonzalez and the Los Angeles Galaxy, the champions of Major League Soccer, for a record fifth time. And speaking of club football records, Egyptian giants Al Ahly won their record-extending 19th African title over the weekend. Al Ahly's latest championship came at home in Cairo. They beat visiting Sewe Sport of Ivory Coast 1-0 to lift the CAF Confederation Cup trophy. The home-and-away series ended 2-2 on aggregate, and Al Ahly won on the away goals rule. Imad Moteyeb scored off a header in the 96th minute. And if you go to the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page at facebook.com/VOA Sunny, you'll see a photo of Moteyeb celebrating his big goal with his teammates. In addition to that Confed Cup crown, Al Ahly has won 8 CAF Champions League African Champions Cup titles, 6 CAF Super Cup championships, and 4 African Cup Winners' Cup trophies. Yes, indeed, the cup runneth over again for Al Ahly, the most successful club in African football history. Well, our African football guru, David Legg, has been looking at the recent draw for the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations tournament. African football's premier competition kicks off January 17th in Equatorial Guinea. And David joins us again this evening from Johannesburg, South Africa. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sonny.
Turning to Group C, David, another very intriguing, very competitive group. We have Ghana and Algeria, which both qualified for the 2014 World Cup in Brazil, South Africa, and Senegal. How do you see Group C, David?
Sonny, I was talking to a South African colleague, Matsalani Mamabolo, who works for the Johannesburg Star, one of the top South African soccer writers. We were discussing the potential pairings a couple of days before the draw, and this is exactly what we came up with as the absolute group of death. In fact, I want a word stronger than death, Sonny. I think this is the group from hell. it is just unbelievably strong. And funnily enough, at face value, I think most people in Africa would say, well, South Africa are clearly now the outsiders in this group. But an interesting statistic, Sonny, they have never been beaten by Ghana, Algeria, or Senegal in the Cup of Nations. So that's something that's going to boost their morale. And what I like about this is, from a South African perspective, here we have a young side. They've done very well in the qualifiers. They held Nigeria twice. They beat Congo once, and they beat Sudan twice. Now, we're really going to find out what this side is all about. What is their real worth? Because this is a group, Sonny. If I just go through the rankings, Algeria are ranked first, Senegal fourth, and Ghana fifth, and South Africa 11th. And I think that speaks for itself. So you've got 1, 4, 5. You've got three of the top five ranked countries in Africa all in the same group. And they're going to play in Mongoma, which is right over in the mainland. I don't think many people anywhere on the continent outside of Equatorial Guinea know exactly where this city is, but it's going to become famous soon enough. I'm very tempted to sit on the fence here, Sonny. This one is just so difficult to call, but I know you won't accept that. So I'm going to go with Algeria. The Algerians were so good at the World Cup and very impressive in the qualifiers. 5 wins on the trot before they lost in Mali. And I just had a sense that that might happen because they'd already got 15 points and they were home and dry. All right, so let me hedge my bet slightly, Sonny. I'm going with Algeria, and then it's going to be a dogfight between Ghana, South Africa, and Senegal for that second place. This is a group, Sonny, where I can see a lot of drawn matches, and I think a side that wins even once, maybe a side that wins once and draws twice, is going to make it through to the quarterfinals. And the opening pairings, which will be on January the 19th, will see Ghana coming up against Senegal. I mean, just the mere thought of those two coming up against each other excites me. And then equally exciting, South Africa against Algeria. And what's ironic there, Sonny, is that South African officials were telling me that they were very keen to play Algeria in one of their warm-up matches. Now, that obviously will not happen anymore because you don't play a side that you're going to face at the Cup of Nations. So perhaps the South Africans, if they want North African experience, will now look at a friendly against Tunisia. But yes, I mean, I'm not going with group of death. This is the group from hell.
David, finally we have Group D, another very strong group. Ivory Coast and Cameroon, which both qualified for the 2014 World Cup. And coincidentally, we're also drawn together during the recent qualifying competition for Equatorial Guinea. And we have Mali and Guinea. How do you see Group D, David?
Well, Sonny, I've just spoke about the group from hell. But this group, in terms of rankings, is even stronger still because all four countries are in the top 10. You've got Ivory Coast third, Guinea sixth, Cameroon eighth, and Mali 10. So in terms of rankings, it's actually stronger even than Group C. So I don't know what we're going to label this one. Group of Hell Mark 2. And as you so rightly said, Ivory Coast and Cameroon, they're going to go at each other again after clashing twice in the group stage. And the Ivorians will be thirsting for revenge because they were humiliated 4-1 in Yaoundé by this new-look, exciting young Cameroonian side. And then in the return match in Abidjan, I was really impressed by the defensive resilience of the Cameroonians, especially when they were, I believe, harshly reduced to 10 men in the second half in Abidjan. And they rather comfortably held out for a goalless draw. So you've got this Ivory Coast team that have been favorites in the last five tournaments, but haven't been brought on the bacon, as they say. Twice runners-up, and that's as far as they got, as close as they got to the trophy. They did, of course, in Gabon, come tantalizing close in 2012. Didier Drogba, in the only time I can remember, Sonny, covering football, blazed the penalty a mile over the crossbar in regular time. And then in penalties, the now famous Zambian victory. They won the shootout. So Ivory Coast were a lot to prove. Cameroon, similarly, four times African champions, but the last time they lifted the trophy was way back in 2002. Samuel Eto'o was gone. Alexander Song, at the moment, not playing in the team. So it's a young, vibrant side, but a lot to prove. And they're going to be really one to watch. Guinea were really impressive in the qualifiers in some of the matches that I saw them play. And, of course, to me, Sonny, they would be everybody's sentimental favorite, a country ravaged by this Ebola epidemic, which has now claimed thousands of lives. And Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, hardest hit. And on behalf of the Sunny Side of Sport, we wish the people of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone all the best in this incredible challenge that they're so bravely fighting at the moment. And last, but certainly not least, you've got Mali. Again, Sonny, just before we went on air, somebody was saying to me, but Mali were not impressive in the qualifying stage. And I said, but remember one thing about Mali. They always finished third. The last Cup of Nations, 2013, Mali beat Ghana for third place. Go back 12 months further to 2012, exactly the same situation. So, I mean, Mali against Ghana, Mali finished third. So you dare not underestimate Mali. And after all, they are a top 10 African country. But that said, and despite my my personal belief that I'd like to support Guinea, Sonny, I'm going to go with, I guess, logic and say that it's going to be Cameroon and Ivory Coast that will emerge victorious from that group. In the opening matches on January the 20th, we'll have Ivory Coast against Guinea and Cameroon against Mali. So, Sonny, everything's set for a fantastic Cup of Nations.
Yes, David, it's certainly shaping up as a fantastic Nations Cup. And this reminder for our VOA football fans, the 30th edition of the Africa Cup of Nations kicks off January 17th when Equatorial Guinea will host Congo Brazzaville in the opening match in Bata. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, we focus on the political situation in Nigeria. And next, tracking gas flaring in Nigeria. But first, some music. Here is Aram Diab of Egypt with Waya.
شايفة احساس انه احلى وابلى الناس خلى قلبي يقول خلاص اهدى بلاقي
Adam Diab of Egypt with Waya.
In Nigeria, the presidential elections are set for February 14th. Analysts say the threat posed by militant group Boko Haram is likely to be a major issue. Incumbent President Goodluck Jonathan, who is seeking a second term, Mr. Jonathan faces fierce criticism at home and abroad for failure to rein in corruption and guarantee security. For some perspective on the political situation in Nigeria, reporter Vincent McCorry spoke with Ujoma Chidibere Nwachukwu. He's the president of the Washington chapter of the group called Nigerians in the Diaspora. Vincent asked him what President Jonathan would do if he were reelected.
He's going to do a lot. He's been doing a lot. And I think one of the things that Nigerian successive governments have not had is continuity. We need continuity in Nigeria. The president came into a semi-comatose society and environment. Nigeria is a very huge country that has agencies and government agencies and establishments that have either become comatose or has been riddled with corruption over the years. Now, I'm involved in debates over the social media. I have a friend of mine who recently asked a question about the past elections in America and the achievements of the present government. Mm-hmm. When they came in, the economy was in a free fall, and right now, if you look at the Dow, it's gone from 7,000 to over 17,000, daily. And the difference between one person now asks, take that and put into Nigeria. How can you describe what Jonathan has done?
Especially given that for the last 5 years, he's been the president.
Right.
Thousands of people have been killed by Boko Haram,
right.
A threat that initially the government, President Jonathan, ignored or rather dismissed as a minor irritation. Where's the achievement?
A lot, actually. You see, we're talking about one section of the economy. We're talking about security. Security, and we're talking about this security. This issue is mostly happening in the northern part of the country. Now, remember, Nigeria is a very huge and diversified society. We have the north, we have the west, we have the south. Now, Boko Haram, as much as it's been treated politically, to me personally, is a cancer. It's a cancer that needs to be rooted out. Now, it might not be completely fair that it started, that Goodluck Jonathan was the president that ignored it. They started during President Obasanjo's time. And he was a person that treated it with a lukewarm attitude. Mm. The president has refused to use brute force because basically Boko Haram is an unidentifiable foe.
You know, the thing is, nobody denies the nature of Boko Haram.
Right.
Everybody's criticism is on the handling. Nobody seems to be very clear about what President Goodluck Jonathan is really doing in terms of, defeating this threat or even in engaging with the citizens who have been severely affected every day. How can somebody defend that policy?
It's a lot that's been done. And now in Nigeria, the GSM cell phones are being registered with names and fingerprints and love. Things have changed. These are security apparatuses that were not there prior to him coming mm-hmm. into power. He has done that. The SSS, there's increased community policing, which in our society right now, due to how Nigeria is currently, it's very hard to have for anybody to really do their job when the community is not really giving you mm-hmm. what you need. Yeah. Now, if the community is so much afraid to because of their identity, now it's very hard for any police officer to do their job or the army. Now, but if you've noticed, there have been some towns that have been taken and they were being retaken back. Now, again, Boko Haram is an unidentified foe. Yeah. If we are facing someone who you can, like I'm with you right now, I know I'm after, going after you, then it could have been fair to put the government in perspective of they are not doing so much. How much can you do without committing genocide? How much can you do without really probably doing things that are that will be against international policies that you are part of and have agreed to?
That was Uzoma Chidibere Nwachukwu of the Washington chapter of Nigerians in the Diaspora. He was speaking with reporter Vincent McCorry.
Nigeria produces more oil than any other African country. With that drilling comes natural gas, much of which is burned off by oil companies in a practice called gas flaring. But just how much gas is flared? Chris Stein reports from the capital Abuja on a new tool that will allow the government and anyone else who is interested to see where and how much gas is being burned in Nigeria.
Gas flares are a common sight in Nigeria's oil-producing Niger Delta region, but for years, there has been no way of telling who has been flaring, where it has been happening, and how much natural gas has been going up in flames. Now, there is. The Gas Flare Tracker is a website that allows governments and anyone else who is curious to see how much gas is being flared across the Niger Delta. Using satellite data, the website displays a map showing all the gas flares in the region, with details about the gas being burned. Andrew Lewis is a technical consultant to the United Kingdom's Department for International Development who worked on the project. He says the tracker shows how much gas is being burned that could be used to generate power in a country where reliable, round-the-clock electricity is practically non-existent.
And the gas power generation potential is absolutely staggering. Just over 27, actually very close to 28,000 gigawatts. As has already been said, that would provide at least 40% of Nigeria's total electricity requirements.
Minister for Environment Laurencia Laraba Malam says for years, Nigeria did not have data like this, and therefore did not know how much gas was being burned.
We didn't have anything. You heard the DG said, or the MC said, anytime we attend foreign conferences, you know, we hear other countries tell the amount, you know, of gas, you know, released into the atmosphere. But we guess. But from today, we will not guess. We will give the correct amount because of this tracker.
Better data could allow Nigeria to force oil companies to pay up for the gas they release. By law, oil companies are supposed to pay $3.50 per 1,000 standard cubic feet of gas burned. But Peter Idabor, Director General of the National Oil Spill Detection and Response Agency, says companies skirt by without paying their fair share.
We believe that the companies are not giving us, they're not paying accurate taxes from the volumes of gas they are supposed to apply, because you can see they gave you a table showing those amounts. But right now we'll be able to know the total amount of gas flared in relation to the tax they're paying, and then the deficit they'll be made to pay.
Idabor hopes more stringent enforcement of fines will encourage companies to use gas for things like power generation, rather than burning it off and releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Chris Stein for VOA News, Abuja.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Huhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Greg Burns, thanks for choosing the Voice of America. Or Greg Burns, rather. Sorry.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A spate of global humanitarian crises has strained the United Nations International Food Aid Program, forcing the agency to sharply reduce food rations to 500,000 refugees sheltered in Kenya. On November 14th, the United Nations World Food Program announced that, as a result of insufficient funding, it would be forced as a last resort to cut in half provisions distributed to men, women, and children living in camps around the East African nation. The refugees, many who have fled conflicts in Somalia and South Sudan, will now receive a daily food ration of just over 1,000 calories in cereals, pulses, and oil. The WFP said that because of emergencies it is dealing with simultaneously in South Sudan, the Central African Republic, Syria, the countries surrounding those states, and countries in West Africa struggling with a massive outbreak of the deadly Ebola fever, it does not have the money needed to provide full daily rations for the refugees in Kenya. The strain is not focused on Kenya alone. Unless more support from donor nations is forthcoming, the WFP may have to cut rations in Ethiopia, where some 600,000 refugees have fled from violence in the region. The United States is profoundly concerned about funding shortfalls being experienced by humanitarian organizations in many places around the world. But nowhere is this shortfall more dire than it is in Africa. From October 2013 to October 2014, our nation has provided more than $5 billion in humanitarian assistance around the world. For refugees in Kenya during that period, U.S. humanitarian aid totaled over $111 million. We welcome the important contributions the United Kingdom and Denmark recently announced for Kenya and urge other countries and entities to make further donations as well to address the growing food insecurity for refugees both in Kenya and worldwide.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, I'm Sunday Shomari. Next on Let's Talk, Dancers in Africa. Dancers in Africa is the topic we'll discuss in our new light-hearted show, Let's Talk. So join me, Sunday Shomari, and my guest as we explore dances in Africa with some hilarity. That's Let's Talk, Monday at 17:30 UTC.
Right here on the Africa service of the Voice of America.